The Catholic Channel Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love with your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York.
Welcome to Just Love. Just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This week, we're going to kind of have a little bit of a diverse conversation this week on Just Love. I'm going to be in the U.S. Virgin Islands and kind of going down on a relief recovery mission with some people from New York State. And one of the reasons I'm going to do that is because although they're very small, those islands, in terms of population, there was devastation there. So one of the things we're going to talk about today, and I'm delighted that my guest who's going to be on very shortly, Jose Calderon, who is the president of the Hispanic Federation, which has done just yeoman's work in the recovery, the relief efforts in Puerto Rico. I'm going to speak with him about that. So that's one of the topics we're going to talk about on Just Love today. In addition to that, a little bit later on in the show, we're going to be speaking, about the upcoming Academy Awards. And we're going to speak about a little bit about heroism and who are some of the heroes in those movies that are coming up and what do they teach us. And I got to tell you, from my own perspective, I'm really interested in having this conversation because they certainly have a lot of anti-heroes in the world today. And maybe it's nice to talk a little bit about heroism. So Leah Labresca, who is a freelance writer, is going to be with us in the studio a little bit later on. So we're here in New York, and this week we have a little bit of a taste of spring, which is good, and we're in the middle of Lent. And actually, Lent is the old English word for spring, so there's a lot of kind of renewal going on. And I don't know, maybe we escaped a lot of snow here in the Northeast this year, but you never know. But so as we continue kind of the Lenten journey, and we kind of say that this is the time of year when we kind of do a little bit of reset. If nature does a reset in terms of renewal in spring, then what we say from our perspective, Lent is an opportunity to kind of renew ourselves. And, everybody talks about fasting as one of those disciplines of Lent, and it's good to fast, to sacrifice, to give up stuff, and to maybe discipline ourselves in that way. But if we're going to really enter into a renewal and a resetting of our lives, in addition to that, there's got to be some positive things. So because we need to draw into closer relationship with God, we should do a little bit more praying during these 40 days in a variety of ways that kind of help us to increase our relationship with God. But there's also the part of Lent, these 40 days, where we also have to do some extra stuff to help others, to serve others. So, if we really want to renew ourselves, and that's what Lent is about, and to enter into the great mysteries of our salvation, the cross and the resurrection of Jesus, that it does involve ourselves, which is a little bit more discipline and sacrifice. It involves God, a little bit more praying, and it involves a little bit more helping and service to others because it involves other people. And those are the three kind of types of relationships that are so critically important to us being fully human. And so it's a great opportunity to reset them, to deepen them, to make them more life-giving to ourselves. So as we kind of say here on Just Love, during these 40 days, you got to hang out more with God. You have to discipline ourselves better, and we got to help others better. So we're in the middle of our 40-day pilgrimage, our 40-day journey to renewing ourselves. So let's now go to our first guest. I am just delighted that Jose Calderon, who is a colleague, a friend for years, is with us. He is the president of the Hispanic Federation. Jose, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
Monsignor, it's a tremendous pleasure to be here with you, of course, and thank you to talk about an issue that's been consuming me and the Puerto Rican diaspora and Latinos and Americans of good conscience for the past 5 months now, 5.5 months.
So, I've been to Puerto Rico twice. You've probably been there more times than that. Let's go right to the chase right now. What is it, about 5 months after the storm hit?
Yeah. So March 20th will be the six-month anniversary since Hurricane Maria hit. We have to remember that Hurricane Irma hit 2 weeks before that as well, too. So, you know, when we think about sort of what's happening in Puerto Rico, some people have been without power now for well over 6 months.
Now, I haven't checked in the past 10 days. What are they saying right now about the number of people on the island, or the percentage of people who are still without power?
So the Army of Engineers actually came out with a statement recently that said that 85% or so of people in Puerto Rico have power. Anecdotally, I can tell you that that's not the case of what we're seeing on the ground. We are working now in the 78 municipalities in Puerto Rico, and there are large swaths of people without power.
Well, one of the things which I've explained to our listeners, and maybe you can make it a little clearer if I didn't, that some of the numbers that they kept using had to do with the capacity, the percentage of
Correct.
Capacity that was being generated.
Correct.
And then the reality was, which I think is right, but that capacity was going to hospitals, it was going
Correct.
To places. I'm not saying they did anything wrong, but to say there was like 70%
Correct.
Of capacity didn't mean that 70% of the households had electricity.
That's a great point, Monsignor. It really is, right? So when they talk about these numbers, they talk about power generation, right? So we're at 85% in terms of power generation, but you're right. Hospitals take up the energy of 1,000 homes, let's say, right? Or a business can take up hundreds of homes in terms of sort of the electrical output of the energy. So that really means that people in Puerto Rico, the number is far higher than that 85% that we're being told. So, you know, I would estimate here that at least 40% of Puerto Ricans, right, or so, are still without power or still have intermittent power.
Yeah. And I mean, the experience which I had, and again, I always kind of issue a disclaimer, when you go down there for a brief period of time, you're not an expert. Because you see what you see, but you get a little bit of it, and you may know some of the questions. You may not know all of the answers, but when I was down there, like right before Christmas, one of the things that it seemed to me is that I saw two different experiences. So in San Juan, I did see a lot of signs that things had come back to a certain extent, but then I went only an hour and 15 minutes to the south of the island, and that was not the same story. Is that a little your experience?
No, absolutely right. So San Juan is, you know, obviously the cultural capital, the economic hub of Puerto Rico. So a lot of attention has been placed, rightfully so, I think, to some degree, around San Juan. There are still pockets of San Juan that are still in the dark, if you will. And even when you go to San Juan, you see that businesses are still shuttered, closed, hotels are still closed. And so you can see that there are issues there. But it's really when you leave San Juan, when you see the true impact of the storm on people's lives, people's homes. I was last week, I was in Jauco with a community of farmers there that lives on the side of these mountains. And they've lost everything. They've lost not only their homes, but they lost their cattle. They lost their crops, and clearly no help is forthcoming, right? So the little help that they're getting, a couple hundred dollars here and there. And so the needs are vast. And really, again, leaving San Juan is where you start seeing the starkness of the situation.
We're speaking with Jose Calderon, who is the president of the Hispanic Federation. And we're speaking about the ongoing tragedy of the disaster of the hurricanes in the Caribbean, and particularly on Puerto Rico. So, Jose, I know that the Hispanic Federation has just done incredible amounts of work there. Tell our listeners a little bit about some of the good work that you've been doing.
Well, thank you, Monsignor. And, you know, we're very proud and privileged to be in a position to help. We're in a position to help because a lot of all of your listeners, right, and people of good conscience, people of good faith across America and many other countries have stepped up and really supporting our people on the island where our federal government has failed in many respects. I think it's people, regular people, who've said, here's $10, here's $20, do something that's meaningful possible for someone there on the island. And so what we have been focused initially, it's been around, you know, the days right after the storm hit, emergency food and water and other emergency provisions there. In some cases, we had to have volunteers climbing the sides of the mountains to get people food and water. We had, you know, just horrible situations on the ground with people without drinking water, right? You can survive without drinking water for 3 days, right? Much longer without food. But that was sort of the initial work that we did, right, throughout the 78 municipalities. 6 million pounds of food have been delivered by us directly, in addition to 24 humanitarian flights. And these are large flights, 747 type airplanes that we loaded up here in the mainland, got to Puerto Rico, and then figured out a way of getting it out of San Juan, right? That was huge logistical challenges of getting it out into many of the parts that were affected throughout Puerto Rico. And I should say again that the devastation of this hurricane is unprecedented in the history of Puerto Rico. It was the entire island that was engulfed by this horrible hurricane. And so there was no part left unscathed. And so the initial focus has been around that. We are now fully immersed around recovery projects, Monsignor. You should be happy to hear that. We're focused particularly around five key areas. Number one for us, agriculture. A little known fact is that Puerto Ricans consume the food that they consume, 85% of it comes from the outside. Which is really, you know, nonsensical. Obviously,
and that was
pre-hurricane, right? Obviously, all of that exacerbated as a result of the hurricane. But we're investing in community farms. We're investing in sustainable fisheries. We think that that is a future for Puerto Rico. It's a tropical island, very lush. We can grow just about anything, and we really want to get that more in balance, right? Where at least half of the food that is you know, consumed in Puerto Rico comes from the island. We're also investing a great deal around the environment. Huge project around reforestation. Prior to the hurricane, we had a huge issue with water erosion, right? The effects of climate change were becoming very evident throughout the island. And so a huge project of, you know, replanting trees, getting the flora and the fauna up and running. And one of the things when you go to Puerto Rico, you start seeing that nature is very resilient, right? And nature is coming back. So that's a positive. We're also investing a great deal around water sustainability. A lot of water filtration systems in homes, right? In schools, community health clinics, community centers generally, to make sure that we never have this problem again, where people are sort of at the brink of dying because they don't have potable water. Also, a lot of investment around housing, right? Sort of getting people's homes rebuilt. And sort of finally, I think the workforce development piece is really important. We have about 40 to 45% unemployment rate right now in Puerto Rico, which is just staggering. And getting people back to work is a major focus of ours.
Jose, on that number, the high unemployment rate, was that before? I know that certainly Puerto Rico was not in good economic shape prior. Was that 40-45 number before, or is that after?
Well, it's, you know, again, you know, it's hard to get accurate numbers. Right. It's hard enough to get it here in the mainland. It's harder back on the island. And so, yeah, I mean, the number has grown clearly, right? I don't know what the number was before. Yeah. But, you know, so many people are idle right now. I mean, it just, again, this community of farmers that are, you know, their very identity is tied to working the land. That's been taken away from them, right? And so many other cases, so many other industries, so many other sectors. And so everyone's been affected. Tourism, obviously, being so important to the local economy is, you know, I wouldn't say at a standstill, but it's still crawling, right? Yeah. A lot of major hotels, even in San Juan, are closed still.
And some of the hotels that I think, you know, maybe a year or two ago would have been places where tourists would have gone, they're now with some recovery workers
Correct.
That are using those hotels.
Correct.
You know, let me shift a little bit, Jose, and say that it seems to me that one of the things I've been saying is, okay, the economic situation wasn't good before. After it, don't we need something like a Marshall Plan?
Sure.
I mean, and again, whatever words one wants to deal with, whether it's debt restructuring, debt forgiveness, tax incentives, or things like that, there are some significant public policy issues and items that should be on our agenda as the United States, because this could be, the way I see it is, this could be a great opportunity to create an incredibly vital economic island.
Absolutely, without question. I'm so happy you mentioned, Monsignor, the Marshall Plan. We have been calling from day one that Puerto Rico needs exactly that. There is no way that we get Puerto Rico back on its feet, get Puerto Rico to heal, if you will, without, you know, a significant investment on the part of our federal government. To date, they've given about $15 billion, and that just happened, by the way, right? So for many months after the storm, Puerto Rico had received almost nothing from the federal government outside of what the emergency relief that FEMA was doing. And so the governor of Puerto Rico has asked for $94 billion. It's a study that was conducted on the island. And that, to us, is exactly what we need to do to get Puerto Rico, to reimagine Puerto Rico, to make it more sufficient, to make it more of a resilient place, and get it to be a place where its people can live in dignity. Today, it's an American territory, as you mentioned. These are American citizens at the end of the day. We did this for Japan. We did this for Germany after World War II. Why not for an American territory that so desperately needs it? And I want to remind our audiences that Puerto Ricans have fought in every American war, right, for the past, you know, century and a half, and have been there just like every other Americans, right? And the one contract that you have with sort of government, if you will, is that, of course, we're going to pay our taxes. We're going to be there in times of war, in times of crisis. But when a crisis hits us, our federal government needs to be there for us. It hasn't been. And so we hope that changes, obviously. And it's really important that listeners call their congressional members to say Puerto Rico matters, because Puerto Rico is part of our country.
You know, Jose, we're speaking with Jose Calderon, who's the president of the Hispanic Federation. We're speaking about the longer term recovery efforts in Puerto Rico. One of the things that has always struck me when these disasters hit, as they do in so many different places, and from our perspective, and I think our perspective at Catholic Charities, and I also think the Hispanic Federation, we provide services to a whole lot of people, but the preponderance of our services are for those who are poorer, sure, those who are more vulnerable, because that's where the need is. And that's part of our vision, that our mission, should be basic necessity. But what is obvious to me is that when a disaster hits, who suffers the most? The people who were poor before the disaster. And to use a big word, well, you know, maybe they have one car that's not in too good shape. So if that gets flooded, they can't do it.
Right.
They don't have two cars.
Right.
If you're a little bit richer and maybe you have two cars and one gets, you still have one.
Correct.
There's not a redundancy of that's there. So it seems to me that again, whether it was, what was it, the third ward in wherever it was in Louisiana.
Right, in New Orleans, yeah.
Which was the poorest,
sure,
section there, that suffered the most.
Yeah.
And again, it seems to me, then that's where the greatest effort has to go in terms of helping
without
people
question,
to recover.
Monsignor. And that's something we were really worried about. I'm glad you also mentioned, you know, the sort of the impact of Hurricane Katrina on New Orleans. Mm. And what we saw happen there, where we had huge swaths of very poor people who never came back to New Orleans, right? Who were pushed out in some ways as a result of this sort of climate disaster. And what we're calling our people, right? We have such a huge swath of Puerto Ricans coming into the mainland now.
Right.
These are climate refugees, right? That are coming here.
Right.
And it is the poorest of the poor, right? If you have means, right?
Right.
On the island, you're relatively okay, right?
Right.
You're back to work in some capacity. You have that second car that's driving you around, right?
Yeah.
Your house has largely been taken care of, but it is the very poor. It is those farmers that I just mentioned in Jauco and so many other people. I mean, I should mention that half the island lives close to the poverty rate, if not, in, you know, again, considered, you know, living in poverty by our federal government. And so it's a huge swath of people who are on the island. But without question, we worry about that Puerto Rico ends up becoming a playground for the very wealthy, with a huge swath of poor people serving those very wealthy. So we want to make sure that at the end of the day, everything that we focus on at Catholic Charities, certainly at the Hispanic Federation as well too, is around sort of this notion of equity, right? You know, how do we lift up all boats, right? How do we make sure that people who are, you know, sort of low income have opportunities to grow into the middle class, that have greater opportunities, and to live a life in dignity, right? That we want everyone to live. We certainly want our families family members, our kids to have that life. And we certainly want others to have that experience as well, too. There is an opportunity, again, to reimagine Puerto Rico, to make sure that that happens.
I think so. Jose, you got a few more minutes if we could turn to a new different topic?
Absolutely.
Okay, so I want to now talk to, and again, I want to make a, because we have listeners throughout the country, and in the East Coast here, there's a real affinity with Puerto Rico, so I don't want people to make a mistake, and Jose said this. I want to turn to the topic of immigration.
Sure.
And with the caveat, not the caveat, just the fact, Puerto Ricans are not immigrants because Puerto Ricans are United States citizens, although sometimes that's a mistake that is made.
Yeah.
But so I thought we might talk about one particular topic, but I'd like to focus a little broader. I mean, as our listeners know, we've spoken a lot about the Dreamers. We've spoken a lot about immigration, and it seems that we got a little bit of a reprieve for a few months at least with that particular issue because the Supreme Court said we're not going to decide it. So it's in place temporarily, at least for another few months. But Jose, we talk about the Dreamers, or we mm-hmm. talk about those, and I think that's a particularly important group. But we have a huge problem of millions of other, and I'm going to use the word, good people who are living in the country who, let's admit it, they came in without the right papers or they stayed too long. Mm-hmm. And now we got to figure out a fair and equitable way to kind of deal with that situation. You see any, I got to tell you, I'm not too optimistic.
Right.
Make me a little bit more optimistic.
I wish I could. I think we're in the same boat. Look, if you study history, and yeah. I think history is apropos because it does, these sort of moments sort of resurface themselves. Mm. We're at this particular moment in American history where we've lost our way when it comes to immigration. We know very well, right, because, again, we've studied history to some degree, that this is a nation of immigrants,
right.
That this nation would not be what it is today without immigrants. In fact, what makes America exceptional is the very fact that it's been able to take people from all across the world, been able to integrate those people and really, again, allow them to give of themselves, right, to give of their contributions, their benefits to the betterment of our country, our state, certainly in New York. I mean, you can't think about New York without immigrants. And so we've lost our way when it comes to that. And so it is, again, people of good faith, I think people of good conscience to, help us find our way again.
Right.
Get back on the rails, if you will, because the irony of all ironies, I was having this conversation yesterday, Monsignor, is that oftentimes it is the people who have no immigrants around them who are the most anti-immigrant voices in America. So people who are surrounded by immigrants love immigrants because we understand the importance and the significance of having immigrants.
But Jose, isn't that basically the story of our humanity?
Yes.
That what we don't know, we're afraid of.
Absolutely.
And the more we get to know something, the more we really like, except a few people. When I get to know them, I gotta say. But for the most part, when we get to know them, and I oftentimes use a few analogies here. Boy, if you're running a business, don't you want to have customers who want to come to your store? Isn't that an indication that your store is pretty good?
Absolutely.
And that they're going to buy from you? Which is why, again, I think, some of the people who have been very, very, in my judgment, good on parts of the immigration debate have been some of the business community.
Absolutely.
Who's saying this is what we need. And as you say, it's sometimes people who don't have experience of immigrants who say, wait a minute, they're taking my jobs. Well, sorry. And again, this is a little bit my pessimism.
Yeah.
So much of public policy right. this day is not fact-based.
Right, correct.
It's just, I have my opinion, you have right. yours, and we don't even want to discuss what the facts are.
Well, it's the polarization of the country, right, which is, sending us down this dark path. I agree with you 100%, Monsignor, that at the end of the day, this is about you know, there's been sort of this campaign of misinformation around sort of what immigrants are. So there's a need for real education. So thank you for your leadership in this space. It's great that, you know, obviously that the listeners here today are getting to hear this conversation. You know, my parents, I can tell you, my parents came from Dominican Republic many moons ago. They came, they overstayed their visa. They were here undocumented and, you know, worked two jobs, both of them, for as far as I can remember, and raised amazing kids, right?
You must have good siblings.
Even that's what I was going to say. Out of the three, you know, I am sort of the black sheep, but the other two have been incredibly successful. And we, you know, that is the American story. That is exactly the American story. You know, I am very much an American, right? I am an American citizen, and I cry for this country. I bleed for this country. I fight for it. I fight for its better angels, and my kids are very much part of the American narrative, as so many other immigrants. And so at the end of the day, we are going to have to find back our way. And I worry now with Congress, as we think about, again, our dreamers, when we think about the actions that are needed today, because things are so polarized that it is just hard to talk common sense, because that's what you want to do at the end of the day. We want to talk common sense. To people and say, well, let's talk about the pros and the cons here, right? Let's talk about this misinformation that's out there about immigrants. And the president the other day, and I know we don't want to get too political, but the president the other day said at CPAC, at the conference, the conservative conference, he started doing this parable about the snake, right? Sort of equating the immigrants almost as snakes. It's someone that's going to turn on you and bite you, right? That has not been the experience of immigrants here, right? Not with the Irish, not with the Italians, not with the Chinese, certainly not with Latin American immigrants or African immigrants or any other immigrants.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting where you say fact-based. I was having breakfast maybe about four or five months ago or something. And I was talking to this guy who was a very, very decent guy, doesn't have a lot of experience with immigrants. And he was talking about deportation and like, you know, illegals, we got to deport. I said, did you know in the last year of President Obama that there were probably about 400,000 people who were deported? He said, no, he never did anything about that. Well, okay, if you want to tell me he should have deported 600,000, I'll accept that as your opinion, but don't tell me you didn't do anything.
Right.
And it's so it's like, you know, I think you're right, Jose. We're polarized. I think without being overly political, we're in a dark political period because all we want to do is shout at each other. All we want to do is I hate listening to political talk shows because half of the conversation is, if this is done, who's going to get the blame? Who's going to get the credit? It's so little conversation about, well, what's the right thing to do for the people of the country?
Correct.
And that's so
well, sick. Here's the good news, right? You wanted to hear some some level of optimism. I think we've been here before.
Yes.
And we have found our way back.
Yeah.
And so you have to, you know, it's frustrating because you're living in the now.
Right.
It's frustrating to sort of take a longer view. But I firmly believe we're on the right side of history in terms of sort of our cause. And we will find our way there. It doesn't mean that we're complacent. It doesn't mean that we sort of sit back and just wait this period out. It just does mean that we have to get involved. And think about the plight of, you know, again, I know you've talked quite a bit about it with our dreamers. These are American kids by every standard that we have as Americans, except that they don't have a piece of paper.
Right.
Right. They were raised with our kids in schools, root for the Yankees, you know, or the Mets. But they're just as American.
They better not root for the Mets.
There you go.
Or. Well, the Mets, I'll let them get away with. But if they root for the Boston Red Sox.
Then we have a problem.
We got a problem.
Yes.
Now, okay.
I've told that to the mayor quite a bit.
I told Corey, and our
new speaker. Yes.
Right now in New York City for listeners throughout the country, we have a very bad situation. Both the mayor and the kind of chief legislative officer in New York City, both are Boston Red Sox fans. And that just is...
How did we let that happen?
I don't know. It's just not a good situation. Anyway, Jose, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Jose Calderon is the president of the Hispanic Federation. Thank you for the work you're doing in Puerto Rico. And thank you for all the work you're doing in so many other areas.
Thank you for your leadership, Monsignor. Okay.
This is Just Love. Let's take a break. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Love God, your neighbor, yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This is our weekly conversation. We talk about what's going on in the world from the perspective of Catholic wisdom and social teaching. Tom, a couple of items which I think are kind of interesting. This is the week of Billy Graham's funeral. And tell us a little bit. I found it intriguing. Tell me about his burial.
Sure, Monsignor. Well, the very, very interesting part of his burial, Monsignor, is that inmates down at Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola, down in Louisiana, they were the ones who actually mated the treated plywood casket for Reverend Billy Graham. And they actually had pre-prepared it back in 2006 at the request of Graham's son, Franklin.
He was the young age of like 87.
Yes, he was. He was, because he died at 99. So he was, you know, I guess they figured he was going to wind up dying soon. But Franklin had been down and he was talking to the warden down there. And as it turns out, the warden of Angola Prison had decided there was some burials that were going on. And unfortunately, at that time, the people were buried in cardboard boxes. And believe it or not, Monsieur, the actual corpses of the inmates had fallen through. So the warden had gotten the people to start to build these wonderful plywood caskets. And Franklin Graham saw this, and he actually asked the warden of Angola to create that for his father. So Billy Graham himself was buried in this casket, and which was created down in the largest maximum security prison in the country. Angola is the largest maximum security prison in the country. So in a sense, you know, Billy Graham was sort of he wasn't between two thieves, but he was kind of buried with the help of people who were incarcerated, and they did good for him.
That's interesting. I think find that to be a very, very kind of moving story, and I'm glad, Tom, that you shared that with us. Well, I got something that I want to share, and everybody, we talked a little bit here about is comparing. How do people do, and they're comparing presidents and how they do. So I found an interesting statistic that was in the news. So this year, which is the first Olympic Games since President Trump took office, that the United States contingent won 23 medals. So in the first Winter Olympics after he took office, we won 23 medals. So how many medals were won in the first Olympic Games after President Obama took office? Tom, you have any sense?
I think, Monsignor, that there were more than 23. I think there were 28.
Were 37.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow.
There were 37.
Okay.
So, and I'll say this to our listeners, it means nothing.
Right.
But I bring it up because it means nothing. Some of the other comparisons that are being used about a variety of things. I mean, we seem to give blame and credit to every president, whatever happens there. You know, if somebody jaywalks, I'm not quite sure it's the president's problem or whatever. But I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
So the first Olympics under Obama, 37 members. The medals, the first Olympics under Trump, 23 medals. So
okay.
I just thought it was kind of an interesting piece of that. You know what, Tom? Let's take a break, and then we will go to our next guest. Our next guest is Leah Robresco, and we're going to hear a few clips from the Academy Awards and talk with her about some of the pictures that are coming up. So this is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. Our world will be more just and will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. You know, we are in the middle of Lent, 40 days, and we get ready to celebrate the cross, the resurrection of Jesus, which are the critical, the most important parts of our faith. Got to be honest with you, I like the Christmas presents better, but when it comes to faith, it really is Easter that is at the center of our faith, and you get there through the cross. And so for these 40 days, we say, you know, you got to get better with yourself, you got to get better with God, you got to get better with others. So we say the three things you got to do during Lent to make Lent real is you got to hang out more with God, you got to pray, you have to discipline, sacrifice, that way you get more in touch with yourself, and thirdly, you got to help others more. And so if you do those things, if we kind of undertake something in each of those areas during these 40 days, we kind of build those three critical relationships, God, self, and others, and we're so much better prepared to celebrate the great mysteries of our salvation, the cross, and the resurrection of Jesus. So I am delighted that Leah Wilibrescu, who is a writer, a contributing editor, who is here with us in the studio. And we're going to talk a little bit about films and heroes and sheroes and all of those type of things. And I'm delighted. Leah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Great, great. How'd you get so interested in films?
Well, I think they're made to be interesting. I think people are
they
all...
They are, and make money, too,
well,
at the same
true.
Time.
But, you know, everyone loves a good story, and it's part of how we explain ourselves to ourselves and to each other. So
I'll tell you, I had gotten into a rut last year and kind of wasn't doing some of the things I wanted to do. So my Lenten practice for last year is I made it a point of seeing one film a week during Lent because I think you can find spiritual values in even lousy films. You know, if the good film, it's better. But so that was one of the things I kind of did last year, and I kind of tried to continue it this year. So you tell me, you want to talk a little bit about Lady Bird?
Oh, I loved Lady Bird.
So let's listen to a clip from Lady Bird, and let's then talk about it.
I hate California. I want to go to the East Coast.
I want to go where culture is, like
how
New
in the
York,
world did I raise such
or at least
snob.
Connecticut or New Hampshire, where writers live in the
get
woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom!
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College and then to jail and then back to City College and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect everybody to do everything.
Lady Bird, is that your given name?
Yeah.
Why is it in quotes?
I gave it to myself. It's given to me by me.
Lady Bird always says that she lives on the wrong side of the tracks, but I always thought that that was like a metaphor. But there are actual train tracks.
What she did was very baller. It was very anarchist.
Put the magazine back!
She has a big heart, your mom.
She's warm, but she's also kind of scary.
You can't be scary and warm.
I think you can. Your mom is.
So, you're not interested in any Catholic colleges?
No way. I want schools like Yale, but not Yale because I probably couldn't get in.
You definitely couldn't get in.
Does mom hate me?
If you're tired, we can sit down.
I'm not tired.
You were dragging your feet.
You are so infuriated.
Please stop yelling.
I'm not yelling. Oh, it's perfect.
Do you love it?
You both have such strong personalities.
Well, I got to tell you, I thought that was a great, great film. I loved it. And so you want to know how unsophisticated I am? I thought it was about Lady Bird Johnson.
I thought that too when I heard it announced. I totally thought it was a biopic about Lady Bird Johnson.
It really was. So, but it was great. What'd you like about it?
Well, one thing I loved was her relationship with her mother. You know, her relationship with two difficult kind of parental figures, her mother and the city of Sacramento, are kind of at the heart of the movie. And one thing I love is in that clip we heard even, there's them fighting, you know, you're yelling, I'm not yelling. Oh, this is great. The two of them have a very complicated relationship where it's almost impossible to ever go, here's a moment where they purely hate each other. Here's a moment where they're in perfect accord. Which I think is more truth-telling from a movie than this is the fight scene, this is the reconciliation scene, now we're done. Each of those is closed.
Yeah, and you're not going to find a more quirky character than her. She's just so quirky in in kind of a delightful way.
Though she's also, she's trying so hard to be quirky and countercultural, it feels often like it's less the expression of something authentically within her and more that she wants to be something different and doesn't know what it is. She, you know, tries to pretend she knows how to smoke, you know, chases that bad news boy. And it feels more like she's also kind of enacting the script of something that's different without really knowing if that is her.
Yeah, I think that's right. I hadn't thought about that, but I think it's like she's treating life like a play, and she's got a part that she wants to play in that act. It doesn't come natural. She's got to try.
Yeah, and I will say one of my favorite wacky things she does is when she goes after the nun's car at her school and covers it with streamers and cans and puts it just married, like, to Jesus, and is sure she's in trouble. And the nun goes, like, it was funny.
Right.
You know, I am the bride of Christ, which is one of my favorite moments because it was a weird prank. But, you know, that kind of rebellion was met unexpectedly with humor and love when the story she thought she was telling is, I'm rebelling, I'm going to be in trouble, I'll be scornful of people who are mad. And so the nun's like, that was hilarious.
Yep, it is. So anyway, that I think for a lot of people was a real sleeper. Mm-hmm. You know, they were waiting for Lady Bird Johnson, and then they decided, well, I'll go anyway because I kind of emotionally made a commitment to the movie, and we'll go see it. So I think that's great. Let's do Wonder Woman, okay?
Oh yeah,
we got a clip from Wonder Woman. Let's do that.
I used to want to save the world. This beautiful place. But the closer you get, the more you see the great darkness within. I learned this the hard way, a long, long time ago.
What is your mission?
To stop the war.
What war?
The war to end all wars. Weapons far deadlier than you can ever imagine.
The war can be ours.
Whoever you are in more danger than you think.
I cannot stand by while innocent lives are lost.
Be careful, Diana.
Who is this woman?
She's my secretary, sir. She's a very good secretary.
It is our sacred duty to defend the world. And it's what I'm going to do.
So, another really, really good and fun movie. I love the line, I wanted to save the world.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about the movie is that when we see Diana leave the world of the Amazons and enter into the human world as we know it, she loves the world so much. And sometimes you wonder, especially at the last act of a superhero movie, when they're saving the world generically, right? Well, the whole world is going to be blown up, so I need to defend it as an undifferentiated mass. Diana comes into the world and just like loves everything particularly and individually. She sees a baby. It's the first baby she's ever seen since there are no babies on Themyscira. She loves the baby. She has an ice cream and she just tells the man who sells the ice cream, you must be so proud. And I think it's so great to see superheroism rooted in that particular delight in the world rather than just a response to a threat.
Isn't that a little bit kind of the gospel definition of being childlike?
Yes, and I think it's absolutely correct. I think Chesterton says that, you know, God's delight in the world is in some ways the inexhaustible delight of a child, that he doesn't tire of us, that God constantly goes, again, again.
I'm glad you mentioned that because Chesterton's too smart for me. He uses words I don't understand. So I'm glad you quoted me something that is good. But there is that, almost a second naivete mm-hmm. about Diana, which is not childishness, but it's that just straightforwardness that she brings to the scenes that are there. It's great. How would you kind of compare contrast Wonder Woman with Black Panther?
Oh, well, I think both are about trying to find a way to love the world and to retain a certain kind of innocence in the face of disruption or distrust. But, you know, Diana comes from a community but is ultimately all alone when she goes to the world. And T'Challa is suddenly elevated to kingship in his community. So while Diana adopts the whole world as his own, T'Challa has a specific responsibility as king and kind of carries a different weight than Diana does, of king of people who've known him their whole lives, who rib him about his love life, and yet he is their king, versus Diana has adopted all these people who don't even know she's adopted them.
Right. I think that is a very good point. One of the global points that I thought was intriguing about it, two movies that were incredibly popular in the past year, and the superhero were not white men.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a little bit of a narrative there that heroism shouldn't be limited to any one gender, shouldn't be limited to any one race or even any one continent. That it's kind of a little bit more dispersed than maybe sometimes gets portrayed.
And I think it also means broadening what kind of stories we tell about superheroes. You know, even men shouldn't be relegated just to punch-em-ups, but I think it becomes more obvious that's not the only story you want to tell when
I'll take a puncher-up other than that dinosaur guy or that machine that came at them. That was pretty scary.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing that's cool about Diana is that her superheroic nature is centered in the feminine genius, right? Because it's this adoption feeling, this love that motivates her thing rather than something to prove.
Right.
A young adult novelist I love, Terry Pratchett, like uses this kind of maternal heroism in his Tiffany Aching novels, where it's just, this is all my land and my people, and I'm responsible for them, and I'll stand between them and evil. And it's not at all, I'll prove who I am. It's like, these are my people, and I'm taking care of them. And it's heroic.
That's great. So let's go to the third one, which is a very different genre. It's Dunkirk, and this is kind of historically, you know, probably pretty accurate. And let's hear the clip from Dunkirk.
The enemy tanks have stopped.
Why?
Why waste precious tanks when they can pick us off from the air like fish in a barrel?
There are 400,000 men on this beach.
He's coming back round!
Where are we going?
Dunkirk.
I'm not going back.
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
If we go there, we'll die.
Again, a wonderful, very different genre of movies, but a wonderful, wonderful story, wonderful images.
Oh, it's the one I cried most for, I think, while watching it. And usually not during the scariest moments, but during kind of the simple heroism and hope of the different people in the story. And I think Dunkirk's a story about scale, things happening over a day, over an hour. But it's a story about the scale of heroism, where we keep seeing people make, or sometimes fail to make, courageous decisions that don't even save them sometimes. We keep seeing people offered the chance to not to despair and keep taking it. And I couldn't believe the poor boys on the beach. You know, they get off, they come back when their ship sought out from under them. How would you not be tempted to give way to despair? And they can't save themselves, those boys. There's nothing they can do to guarantee they'll live. They just keep choosing hope. That's what's in their power. And that is the one thing we can hold on to.
And it was an incredibly kind of motley group of individuals, mm-hmm, who together created kind of a mosaic that saved.
Absolutely. And I think we see as the audience more moments of courage and generosity than any of the individuals do in the people they encounter. And it's nice to remember that we kind of see only one scale of Dunkirk in our lives, but are constantly touched by the choices other people have made that Nolan is not around to reveal to us. But in the beatific vision, hopefully, we get to see at all those scales.
So you got a prediction?
Oh, for the winner?
Yeah.
Man, I'll say Lady Bird just because it's small and excellent, but yeah. I just don't understand what Oscar voters are actually picking on.
I don't know either, but I'd be happy if it doesn't make any difference because a lot of good ones. And the one I know you haven't seen, but I'd put it on your to-see list is Three Billboards of Ebbington, Missouri.
You and my mom both telling me to see it.
Well, it is incredibly dark. Mm-hmm. It is an anti-hero, but the main character is just a phenomenal character in an anti-hero way. It is it's very, 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 very powerful in what it portrays, and there's some kind of interesting twists in it, which are not all that unexpected, but they're kind of intriguing there. Hey, Leia, thank you so much for joining us on Just Love and making our listeners a little bit more attuned to what they can see in movies. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, and my hearty thanks to the filmmakers also. It's been a good year.
It really has. It has been good, and I encourage our listeners, you know, that can be a Lenten practice. Make sure you see a film, look for the spiritual values in it, see how it draws you kind of closer to God, maybe closer to somebody else, and maybe gives you even a little bit of insight into yourself. You know, so we have spoken about the ongoing emergency in Puerto Rico. As I mentioned, I'm going to be in the U.S. Virgin Islands because that has been, to a certain extent, underpublicized. It's a small place, not that many people, only a few hundred thousand people, but devastated. I'll talk a little bit more about that when I come back because I've seen it firsthand. But I think, you know, we movies, celebrities, everything, you know, we have about a 10-day attention span. But these big disasters, they require years and years and years of recovery. So we shouldn't let those people, you know, stay out of, fall out of our attention. There's need for ongoing work that is there. So I'm glad we had an opportunity to speak about that. And in the upcoming weeks, we have other things we're going to speak about relevant to some of the events that have been happening down in Florida, some of the issues of school violence. I want to talk about that a little bit about how we deal with guns, a little bit how we deal with mental health issues. And if you want to know a little bit more about what we talk about, just check out my Just Love blog or follow me on Twitter at MSGRK Sullivan. Thanks for being with us on Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.